Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Welcome to our legal roundtable, where we look at where issues and the law intersect. And on today's program, we'll spend some time talking about the sudden death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. What does it mean for the court, the president, and the election? We'll also look at the issues that the city of Ferguson and the Justice Department squaring off. Professor Melissa Click is going public on a confrontation with the Mizzou administrators. Joining me in studio to talk about these and other stories, Bill Freivogel is professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center. And with us once again is Jared Boyd, president of the Mound City Bar Association and chief of staff and counsel for the St. Louis Treasurer's Office. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi.
Nothing really to talk about, is there?
Uneventful weekend.
Quite an eventful weekend. You know, is there anything that we can say that hasn't been said, Bill, about this Justice Scalia death and its fallout?
Well, I guess I would agree with a lot of what has been said, but I think he was a great as a legal thinker. He was a great justice, probably one of the great justices of the 20th century or the last century on the Supreme Court. And probably the greatest justice since William Brennan, who was the sort of very famous and influential liberal coalition builder of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And his contribution is these two things, originalism and textualism. And originalism is the Constitution is a dead document. It means what it was written to say. Textualism is a law means what the words say. If the legislators use the wrong words, that's their problem. The law still means what the words say. And but you know, I think in a lot of ways he then set the terms for the decision making on the Supreme Court. A really good example of that is the Heller case we've talked about sometimes. This is the one that found an individual right to Second Amendment right to have a gun to protect yourself and your house. And Scalia wrote that opinion. And what's really interesting is that even though it was a 5-4 decision, that all the dissenters were fighting on the same turf. You know, the dissenters like Justice Stevens was saying, well, you're applying your own way of going at this wrong. The history of the Second Amendment doesn't recognize this sort of individual right. Now, having said all that good stuff about Justice Scalia, I do think that it's going to have he'll be examined also as and probably be found to be on the wrong side of a lot of history when it comes to women's rights, abortion rights, same-sex marriage, school desegregation, right of people to have a right to a lawyer, to be told their rights when they're arrested. On all these things, he was sort of pre-Warren court, and oftentimes his dissents in these cases were insulting both to individuals, to women, to same-sex couples, but also to his fellow justices on the Supreme Court. You know, all these terms like jiggery pokery, and you know, saying that nobody ever a set of facts that Justice Sotomayor came up with. You know, no one could ever believe those, and so he had all sorts of insults for his fellow justices. I remember very vividly seeing him as Justice Kennedy announced the decision from the bench, saying graduation prayers violated. In public schools violated the Constitution. And I remember seeing the way in which Scalia reacted to Kennedy reading that from the bench. It was really sort of nasty. And in that way, you know, I can remember when Scalia was nominated, people thought, well, maybe since he's so gregarious and such a great guy, he has these friends like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's a liberal justice, and they're great friends and still were actually.
Best buddies, as she put it.
You know, that maybe he would be the kind of coalition builder for the conservatives on the court. He wasn't. I mean, if you want to really know who's the conservative justice who has had the most impact on the direction the court's going, it's Justice Kennedy.
Right. Mark, what's your take on all this?
I was going to say that I think you're exactly right about not being a coalition builder, even among the conservatives, because he just would take his extreme position. I think, you know, what Bill's saying about being on the wrong side of the history, I think Scalia would say, you know, well, maybe he, you know, maybe I was, maybe I wasn't. But he would say it's not for the court to make those changes, that it's for the legislature. And he was very big on this idea that the Constitution is an agreement between the ratifiers and that we should, and it's almost like a contract, and that's what we're bound to. And so the idea that, you know, he would say there's nothing in the Constitution that protects the right to an abortion. There's nothing in the Constitution that protects gay marriage. And in fact, if you look at how gays were treated at the late 1700s, he would say, well, that's what the Constitution says. Legislatures can change that. And he might say, look, they are changing it. Now, that's great as a theory of government. It's not so great when you're the person who's kind of being ostracized by the law, being treated badly by the laws, to sit saying, well, let's just sit around and wait until, you know, another 50 years when everything gets better. That's not and I think also this idea that some people view the Constitution is not just a legal contract. It's also kind of an aspirational document. That's a little bit dangerous because, you know, the justices become untethered then. That's the fear, that they'll start doing whatever they want.
Jared?
Thank you for having me back, Don. I think Justice Scalia's death really has made people think about how undemocratic the Supreme Court is. It's probably our least democratic institution. If you receive a lifetime appointment, you'll probably serve for 30 years absent poor health. And with the exception of the Warren Court, the Supreme Court throughout our history has really acted and led from behind and thwarted civil rights initiatives, populism, wage protections, and has really been behind the president and particularly the House of Representatives in enacting changes that help people, whether it's civil rights or wage regulations in the Lochner era. So I think people really have the opportunity to reexamine the role of the Supreme Court and think about what Scalia's successor will have the power to do. They'll have the power to weigh in and be the final arbiter on issues like abortion and birth control. And these are people who will be unchecked after they are appointed, after they are confirmed by the United States Senate.
Is the Supreme Court hobbled now? There's a 4-4 split, liberal versus conservative. Is the court hobbled now until a successor is named? That might be 18 months from now, from what we're hearing, in the meantime.
There are a lot of hot-button issues that are on the docket for the Supreme Court this term, including abortion, environmental regulations, affirmative action, public labor sector participation. And if those decisions come out in 4-4 ties, the lower court decision will be affirmed, but there will be no Supreme Court precedent. The only exception to the hot-button issue cases that will probably not result in any type of precedent is the affirmative action case, because Justice Kagan has to recuse herself from that case. Yeah. So there is a possibility that that case can result in a 4-3 decision. But in the instances where the cases will be decided 4-4, then there will be no precedent. So we're talking about cases this term and potentially next term.
So I think we don't know for sure whether or not they'll just leave it 4-4 and say so the lower court opinion stands, or whether they'll ask the cases to be re-argued. I mean, one reason that they might not ask the cases to be re-argued is if the Republicans are actually able to fulfill their threat not to confirm anybody, and then we have another election, there's not going to be another person able to be confirmed until the end of next year's term. So that would be a really, really, and I think unprecedentedly long time to be going with a bench that's that's evenly divided. The case that Scalia's death will have the biggest effect on, most likely, is the one about government labor unions and whether or not the mandatory dues checkoff was constitutional. It was very clear from the oral argument that was held last year that the conservatives were going to prevail in that case. It would appear as though they will not be able to prevail now, that it'd be 4-4 in the lower court opinion. Was that labor unions could continue to have mandatory dues checkoff. Another one was an important voting rights case, whether or not districts should be based upon the number of residents or the number of voters. And that's another one that could well end up evenly divided in the lower court decision again. In that case, was the more liberal side of that, which is based on residents rather than citizens.
What about but to answer your question whether it's been hobbled, I don't think the court's going to be hobbled because most decisions are not 5-4 decisions. So the court will probably be able to continue on with at least 80% of his work, I would say. But yeah, there'll be some issues.
The Affordable Care Act case that you just brought up, Don, that gets really complicated because the courts of appeals around the country have taken different views. As a matter of fact, our own Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has given lots of recognition to the religious views of groups that don't want to go along with the contraceptive mandate, saying they shouldn't have to sign a form saying that they have conscientious objections to it. And so if the Supreme Court were to end up – I think they're supposed to hear these like seven related cases next month. If the Supreme Court were to end up 4-4 on that, which is quite likely considering how they voted in the previous case, then we wouldn't have – I mean we'd have very confusion. The law would be different in different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see that with regards to abortion restrictions as well. Abortion restrictions that are allowed in Texas probably won't be allowed in a lot of other circuits. And the Supreme Court is specifically required to resolve those circuit splits, and that's one of the reasons that they're hearing this case, the abortion case.
Well, I think in the abortion case, I think that people felt as though because five justices on the court stayed the parts of the Texas abortion law, I think they – and that would not have included – those five would not have included Scalia.
Right.
I think people think that Scalia being gone from the other side of that will only strengthen the hand of the justices who want to throw out large parts of the Texas law.
We should point out, too, the 5-4 rulings have been coming down primarily in these hot-button cases
that
we're talking about. Most of the rulings in the Supreme Court are not 5-4.
Right.
Correct?
Right.
Right. All right. We have to take a break. Let's do that now. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about the potential successor for Justice Scalia. We'll do that in a moment. My guests in studio, Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Jared Boyd. It's Legal Roundtable Day. We'll be back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Again, and welcome back. We'll continue for a little while with Justice Scalia, but the big question and the big controversy right now is the fact that President Obama, by constitutional prerogative, is to name a successor. The Republicans say that he shouldn't do that. It should be left until a new president takes office. Is there any legal ground, constitutional ground, Jared, for the Republican Party to deny or suggest that the president make this nomination?
It's interesting because while the Constitution does provide the Senate with the ability to confirm the president's nominee, a lot of what will go on in terms of naming Scalia's successor and providing that person with a hearing will be governed by Senate rules, which really don't mean anything. They allow themselves to regulate themselves, and rules that once were provided to govern this process will probably be thrown out of the window. So while the Constitution does provide them with the requirement to consent or provide some affirmation to the republic, to the president's choice, they really don't have to do it with their rules.
It's advice and consent. That's what they're supposed to do. And if they want to drag their feet on it, I mean, politically, I think it's an issue, but I don't think legally anyone could force them to do anything.
Well, as Donald Trump said the other night in that very contentious debate, delay bill. I mean, that's a tactic that could put this thing off for months and months, well beyond the election.
Well, like Bill said, for like almost, I mean, for two more terms, right?
Yeah, right. I think the only thing that could force the Republicans to actually hold hearings is if they think they're losing the issue in the political campaign. I mean, you know, we always talk every presidential election year. We say, oh, it's really important who you vote for the future of the Supreme Court. And nobody ever pays any attention to it, really, or maybe not too many people do. This time, I think people are not going to be able to avoid paying attention to it. I think we're going to hear a lot about a living constitution and a dead constitution and you know, a court that's too activist and et cetera.
Once he's going to name someone, he said he's going to, but once that nominee has a face and a reputation, that will tend to change things somewhat as well, because then we're talking about a real person with a real record, and folks in the outside of government will be making their opinions known, I'm sure.
Yeah, and if it's a nominee who the Republicans think they can make look bad, maybe they will hold hearings and vote the person down. And thinking that they, you know, that way they could sort of win in the political arena. But if they held hearings for a person who has a sort of a good face for the public, then that they might see that as a loser and just try to delay and delay, and you know, unless people just start putting a lot of pressure on the Republican leaders. But you know, one of the people who's in one of the more moderate Republicans is up for re-election. Several of them have actually already said that they don't want there to be hearings. So, and they would seem to be the people who would be most vulnerable to political pressure.
And there are different incentives for different Republican senators. There are Republican senators from swing states, but the vast majority of the Republicans in the Senate fear a primary more so than they do a Democratic opponent. 1972 was the last year that the Supreme Court had a majority of democratically appointed justices. So this is going to be probably the biggest issue on the Republican side for the senators.
One of the names that has come up is one that none of us has yet learned how to pronounce. Right. This Indian jurist who was approved by the Senate when he was confirmed 97-0.
D.C. Circuit.
For the D.C. Circuit. Now, you put this gentleman back in contention here. How are those who voted for him going to explain their vote?
And the D.C. Circuit is kind of – it's the AAA team for the Supreme Court. So that's where Scalia came from. And also, his record – he's not done a lot of law review writing about what he thinks the law should be. He's just written, you know, case decisions where he's kind of decided cases. So I think he's more like a suitor or something, you know, with less of a record that you can use against the justice. So
that's a Sri Srinivasan, and he's 48 years old.
Oh, thanks Bill, after I just said
showing us all up.
Just taking a shot at it. And it would be interesting that he would be the first Hindu on the Supreme Court if he were nominated and were confirmed. But, you know, maybe the Republicans would say, this guy's 48 years old. He doesn't have enough of a track record to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. Some people have suggested maybe senators. You know, maybe the Senate would be more open to a senator. I've heard some local people talk about, well, how about Claire McCaskill? She was a prosecutor. She's a middle-of-the-road kind of Democrat.
Not to the Republicans in the Senate.
Well, our Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota is another name that has been suggested. I think one name that's come forward is Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General. Not only is she have the background as a prosecutor and highly respected on both sides of the aisle before, at least when she was a prosecutor, but also she's an African-American woman. And so if you're looking at this in terms of what is going to be a potent political symbol if the person is turned down by the Republicans, she might well be.
Well, it's going to be very interesting, and that seems almost trite to say that, mm-hmm. given what's likely to happen over the next several months, but certainly going to be fascinating to watch the imaginations of all parties involved in this thing. Let's leave Justice Scalia, we'll say, rest in peace for the moment as far as we're concerned, and move on to some other things. One of the issues I wanted to get to, and it's important to talk about, is this consent decree flap between Ferguson and the Justice Department. Justice Department is now suing Ferguson because Ferguson has requested revisions in that draft consent decree. But Mayor Knowles says there was no final agreement. Jared, it certainly seemed to most of us that there was an agreement.
I don't know if I would characterize the 131-page consent decree as a list of suggestions.
No.
Consent decrees are final, and there is a clause in the consent decree that basically says this is the final consent decree and that any conversations or anything that is outside the corners of the consent decree does not apply. Everything that binds the parties is within this 131-page document. It appears that Mayor Knowles may either think that they can get out of the consent decree by working with St. Louis County to turn over their police department, or perhaps he just doesn't understand the process.
A friend of mine put it this way. They paid Uber lawyer Dan Webb of Chicago $1,400 an hour to get the best deal they could, and now they think they have a better idea for how to go forward. I mean, this is just they're going to lose. It's going to cost them more money. I thought that I mean, I've been sympathetic sometimes to the position Mayor Knowles is in, but I thought his interview in which he said that they didn't have a deal was aberrational. He was talking about how he thought they were going to save money in the end through going to court. Like I say, that it's going to cost them more money. And he also said, he was asked, you know, he said he had not seen any evidence from the Justice Department or on his own of any kind of constitutional violations of policing or operation of the municipal courts in the city of Ferguson. Well, the March 3 Justice Department report was chock full of more than 100 pages of them showing that a lot of the very minor things like jaywalking and failure to comply were almost entirely enforced against African Americans.
But, Mark, this whole deal is about money, is it not? Because Ferguson simply can't afford
it. They'll continue to exist as a – I mean, this is going to be the issue as we start saying you cannot take all this money from these traffic tickets. I mean, that's been their – these little speed traps have been the way they've kept going. And if you cut that out, they're not going to be able to keep going.
But ironically, Jared, it's going to cost them – probably a couple of million bucks to defend themselves against the Justice Department suit.
Ferguson's own attorney, Dan Webb, has said that it will cost between $4 and $8 million to defend this case and will take several years, not to mention the fact that the Department of Justice has brought 77 of the investigations against police departments since the enactment of the law that they're being prosecuted under, and only one jurisdiction has won and beaten the Department of Justice, which recently occurred, I believe, in North Carolina. But that's a pretty good record for the Department of Justice. Most of those investigations have resulted in consent decrees because those jurisdictions understand the gravity of those investigations and the resources that are available to the Department of Justice to bring those type of cases.
I've seen it suggested that maybe Ferguson is just trying to buy time and wait for a new administration to come in where there might be an attorney general or a Justice Department that might be a little more sympathetic. Does that carry any weight with you gentlemen?
Well, I mean, that sort of thing has happened before.
Yeah.
I can remember way back when the Reagan administration came in, they changed the position on the St. Louis County School to segregation case. So it does happen. But, you know, I don't think they have – it takes a while. Even assuming Republicans won and wanted to no longer enforce this particular law as strongly as it's been enforced by Holder and Obama, it would take a while for all of that to change. I don't think Ferguson's
got
time.
It's at least a year. I mean, you're not going to get the new president until a year from now. So – yeah, it's going to be very expensive.
340 days that we're going to have to wait – both of these things.
And like,
that we've been
and like you said,
about.
I mean, the Department of Justice, talk about unlimited resources. I mean, those are not the guys you want to go up against in a lawsuit.
Very, very quickly, I'd like to get to a couple of other things, then get to some calls. We have calls on some of the obvious things that we've talked about. The state of the judiciary address was made since we last met by Chief Justice Patricia Breckenridge here in Missouri. She is obviously working to improve confidence in the court, but let me just give you one sentence out of her speech. The Supreme Court also realizes it's critical for those of us who sit in judgment of others to be aware of any bias. Therefore, all judges in Missouri this year will receive implicit bias training as part of their annual education program. You know, to me, the story is not that she has said that, it's that it's needed. Needed. Does this strike you that way?
Well, I think that the Missouri Supreme Court, both Justice Breckenridge and her predecessor Mary Russell, have done a really good job of responding to Ferguson, and it because so much of it has involved the operation of municipal courts, I think it was a fairly small step to say an important step, but not going too far to say. We've got to make sure the judges who are running these courts and any court in the state of Missouri aren't operating with implicit bias. I mean, it's too bad that this is 2016 and we still have to say that, but we still have to say that.
Any other thoughts, Pierre?
The Supreme Court has a working group both on municipal court reform and on racial and ethnic fairness. Yeah. So it was in line with those two initiatives to require judges to undergo bias training, and we'll definitely see what the Supreme Court has in store with regard to the Municipal Court Working Group. Municipal courts hear twice as many cases as all the other courts, and the Supreme Court has to recognize that if citizens have a bad experience in those places, it leaves a black eye on the entire justice system.
To me, it's putting the judges in the same category as the police who have to undergo this training as a result of all of this.
I guess I see it differently. You know, at the university, we do lots of training on these things, and I think you always take things out of it. And the idea, whether it's this implicit, this bias that you have inside you that you don't even know you have necessarily, or with transgender individuals. So maybe 10 years ago, you didn't think about it as much, and now you need to think about it more and you want to do the right thing, but you just don't know. So I don't see this as that big a deal, and I think it's something appropriate, and I don't think it's – I wouldn't view it as a condemnation of the judges. I just think it's wise to do this kind of training.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't put them necessarily in a very good light, I think, if it has to be pointed out this way. That's just my personal thought. Again, Missouri Supreme Court has issued a ruling on Constitutional Amendment Number 5. That's the Gun Rights Amendment, which was passed by 60% of the electorate just a couple of years ago. What happens now? This is aimed primarily at felons' rights to carry, as I understand it. Nonviolent felons. What does it do to the amendment in total or – Well,
it seemed to me that Justice Stith, who wrote the majority opinion, was saying, as the court has been saying ever since Amendment 5 passed, that it really didn't change the way in which the court was going to interpret gun rights in Missouri, that already the court uses very what's called strict scrutiny, a very high constitutional test to look at gun laws that regulate guns, and that applying that test to nonviolent felons that the government meets that test, that there's a compelling government reason to make sure that felons don't have guns.
Right. We were talking before the show, Justice Scalia wrote the Heller decision, and he's a big – one of his things is you shouldn't – he didn't like balancing tests. He didn't like uncertain tests. He liked kind of bright tests. And yet he's not real clear in the Heller decision about what test he's using, although it's probably strict scrutiny. But he also specifically said in that decision, there's still going to be reasons that you can forbid somebody to have guns. And he mentioned felons. He didn't limit it to violent felons, and that's one of the – does that mean violent or nonviolent? Mentally incapacitated, concealed carry. I think there were four things there. Oh, place, place and manner kind of restrictions, and that he said, of course you can continue to do that. So they're kind of saying, look, at you're saying strict scrutiny, but even under that, you've got some restrictions and this is fine.
And I think Justice Tidelman dissented in this case has some very strong legal arguments. While the state does have a compelling interest in regulating public safety, he didn't feel that this amendment in particular, or the nonviolent prohibition on guns, was narrowly tailored. Anytime you regulate something that is constitutionally protected, it has to survive strict scrutiny, which means that the government not only has to have a compelling interest, but the regulation has to be narrowly tailored. And he did not feel that this particular prohibition on nonviolent felons owning guns is narrowly tailored, because there's really not a lot of evidence to show that nonviolent felons have a higher propensity for violence several years out against the general public. And then, two, the category of nonviolent felons is broad and expansive. You're talking about folks who may have bet on horses outside of a track or have cheated on their taxes. So he, I think, has a pretty strong argument that while the government has a compelling interest in this case under the constitutional amendment, it's not very – it's not narrowly tailored to meet that compelling interest.
And also, I mean, Amendment 5 did say – I mean, the exception they made was for convicted violent felons, and how we're now applying this to nonviolent. The Stith was kind of saying they should have specifically said and not and nonviolent is different. That seems – I don't know. I didn't necessarily have the same logical jump.
We have to take a break now. We'll do that. I want to come back and talk about Melissa Click, a name that's becoming increasingly familiar in this part of the state and other parts as well. This is Legal Roundtable Day. My guests in studio are Mark Smith, from whom you've just heard, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University. Also with us is Bill Freivogel, Professor of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. And we have Jared Boyd with us in the studio once again. He's the President of the Mound City Bar Association and Chief of Staff and Counsel for the City Treasurer's Office. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our legal roundtable discussion. I'd like to move on to the Melissa Click story here. As people probably remember, she's the suspended professor who called for muscle to deal with a student journalist during a student demonstration on the Mizzou campus last November. Her job may be at stake, but the prosecutor has settled for community service rather than jail time for her actions on that campus that time. She is speaking out, by the way, about all of this. We have a very brief clip from KBIA in Columbia. Here's what she had to say.
The students were using their First Amendment rights to assembly to be present, as were the MU faculty and staff who were there. And so, again, I didn't believe the person who approached me was working for the media, and I, in fact, learned afterward he was not on assignment that day and was not a journalism student. So my instincts told me that there was something I should be concerned about there. And so my goal was to protect the students who I believed were under threat, and I wanted to protect their First Amendment rights to assembly.
So the First Amendment comes into play in a couple of ways here. Jared, you're shaking your head. The First Amendment, freedom of assembly, and the freedom of speech, and Melissa Click calling for muscle.
I don't think her actions are protected by the First Amendment. You can't threaten people. That's generally not protected speech, one. But two, I don't know if we've spent more time talking about third-degree assault / misdemeanor than we have in the Melissa Click story. Yeah. Certainly it involves academic freedom and other hot-button issues, but the underlying crime just seems so small to me in proportion to the amount of coverage it's received and the amount of attention paid by the state legislature.
Once again, there was video, so that gives it an added volume, if you will, if I can put it that way, in this whole situation. She gets 20 hours of community service, is what I understand, rather than any jail time. But
as you say, this is another one of those videos that went viral. I didn't the clip we just heard from her. I thought she was being very misleading.
Yeah, me too.
Because she said, she had the gut feeling this guy wasn't really a journalist. I mean, his name is Mark Schreerbecker, and he's a freelance videographer who's worked as a press person before. And if you go back and watch the video, she says, let's get this reporter out of here. She's calling for muscle to get this reporter. Well, she's now saying she didn't think it was a reporter. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense. And I haven't said that. I think clearly she's right. The students had a right to assemble, a First Amendment right to assemble. The reporters, including the freelance videographer, had a right to document that and to take pictures of it. She apparently committed an assault by pushing them and then threatened one of them by calling for muscle. I really hope that the University of Missouri doesn't necessarily use this to fire her because the state legislature is putting a lot of pressure on them. I don't think that university professors should generally be fired because they've taken unpopular actions on campus.
And yet there's another video that has surfaced over the weekend with regard to yet another incident in which she apparently used language that was considered inappropriate to law enforcement officers, and the acting chancellor, I guess, at Mizzou has reacted to that very strongly.
Yeah. I mean, this whole thing, I agree with you. It's a third-degree misdemeanor assault. It's not, and it's bad judgment. I'm like you, troubled with her explanation for it because that bothered me more because it seemed very disingenuous. The second thing, I watched it. I've been out with police officers and seen people yell much worse at police officers. And so maybe I missed something. I only watched it once. But, they were out in the street and the police officer saying you got to get on. And people, when they're protesting, don't like to move and they take their time and they say things. The chancellor seems to be making a big deal of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the chancellor, the acting chancellor, I guess he's interim chancellor, Hank Foley, it seems to me that he is really overreacting to – I mean, she was being sort of, yelling at the police officers. And that's not nice, but I don't think that I saw her violating anybody's rights. And for the chancellor to say, that he is her conduct and behavior are appalling. I'm not only disappointed, I'm angry that a member of the faculty reacted this way. I mean, it sounds to me like he's prejudging the whole case. So I think that was sort of.
But he may be responding, like you said, to political pressure.
Well,
from the
he may be, in which, yeah. But he shouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, she's in trouble now, and even more trouble, one would think. We have any number of things we could continue talking about, but I'd like to get some of the listeners into the conversation about some of the things we've already talked about. And here's an interesting question that I wonder if any of us can answer. It comes from the Bevo neighborhood, and Rich will join us. Rich, go ahead. You're on the air.
Taking my call again. I'm just wondering what happens to the day-to-day functioning of the court when a justice dies? His clerks in particular, do they just pack up his office, or if they redistribute among the other justices, do they transition when a new justice finally shows up, or what? And by the way, Melissa Click's video you just played, that was an eye roller.
Oh, yeah. All right. Rich, thanks for the call.
I wish we knew the answer to that. I'm sort of guessing they do pack up his office. Maybe they can help other justices with chores before the end of the term. It doesn't look as though there's any likelihood that there's going to be a replacement justice before the end of the term. And so then that after the term's over, that issue sort of goes away.
But on the other hand, I mean, if you're a United States Supreme Court clerk – it's not like they're going to be out of job and having to collect unemployment. They could They can go to a big D.C. firm and probably triple their salary because I'm sure even the Supreme Court clerks don't make that much money.
I had a law professor who's clerked for two Supreme Court justices, and he clerked for a judge that passed away, and the judge that succeeded him took the previous clerks and just allowed for them to finish the term. That being said, that occurred in an era where you probably had only a few months in between a vacancy right. opening and a vacancy being filled. I think this situation will be unprecedented, so I can't predict what will happen to those clerks.
Any idea what the clerks make? You know, I didn't know if they did it pro bono.
I don't know, but you know, even though they have the title of clerk, which doesn't sound that great, I mean, to be a clerk for a Supreme Court justice is huge. I mean, Ted Cruz is an example of a person who was a clerk for a Supreme Court justice. Chief Justice Roberts
was a clerk.
Roberts was a clerk for Rehnquist. Rehnquist was a clerk for, I think, maybe Jackson. So, these are really important positions.
You're paid as a federal employee, but if you go into the private sector, you'll probably get at least a six-figure bonus for being a Supreme Court clerk because it's such a prestigious and coveted position.
We have presented to me here, a Wall Street Journal has written about this apparently, and I'll quote, Justice Scalia's staff is expected to stay in place, but the court had no information about the future of his law clerks. If history is any guide, his current clerks should find work elsewhere on the court, but the newcomers may have a harder time finding a role at the Supreme Court, particularly if no new justice is in place by the time President Obama leaves office. Mm-hmm. So that we did get an answer, I think, pretty much to Rich's question. Another question concerning the Scalia story. Jay in Normandy, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. On the Heller decision, is there any chance of a reversal and any chance that the individual right of firearms to own could be changed? So that's number one. And number two, on the environmental side of things, on the Clean Power Plan, that was, I understand, kind of on hold. But the problem is our air continues to get more polluted and such, and CO2 rises. What's the status of that Clean Power Plan? I guess nothing happens now for the time that they don't have a justice. Thank you.
The Clean Power Plan is the emissions issue that the court dealt with the other day.
On Heller, which is this individual right to have a gun to protect yourself. I think we're going to hear a lot about this in the succeeding months because it seems to me one of the strongest arguments the Republicans are going to have for why they will not proceed with an Obama nominee is that an Obama nominee will be a sure vote to reverse Heller and take away Americans' gun rights. And I think that is a fairly potent political argument. Whether or not the court actually would do that, I think Heller was like 2007, 2008. The court has a whole way of looking at precedents. You know, to what extent has the country come to depend upon a precedent?
Right.
So they could well not overturn it, even if they had the votes to do it. I think Citizens United is a more likely.
Right.
I think without a doubt, Citizens United would be overturned by a new justice who voted to overturn it. And by Citizens United, I'm talking about the court's decision that corporations can make labor unions can make unlimited contributions, expenditures on behalf of candidates during election campaigns.
Corporations are people.
Corporations are people.
Are people.
Yeah. With regard to the EPA case that the caller referenced, Scalia's death will directly impact that case and will put more pressure on the D.C. Circuit to hear this case. The Supreme Court stayed an Environmental Protection Act regulation that was set to go in place before the D.C. Circuit actually heard the case, which was unprecedented. The D.C. Circuit will hear the case on June 2nd, and after that, the Supreme Court was expected to review the D.C. Circuit ruling. Now, if it's a 4-4 decision, the D.C. Circuit ruling would be upheld, dealing with cuts to power plants. So that will definitely be affected by Justice Scalia's death.
But had Scalia died a week earlier, that stay would never have been issued, and the president's plan would have gone into effect. And, you know, that has repercussions on the whole Paris Agreement.
Paris Accord. Of course it does. One more quick call, and we'll bring in Scott calling from Chesterfield. Scott, go ahead. Make it quick, please.
Yeah. I think nonviolent offenders would include somebody convicted of being a drug dealer, or Al Capone, who was convicted of tax fraud. So that amendment, the language was a lie. A judge put it on the thing, on the ballot, and it didn't tell people that.
All right, thanks for the call.
Well, and that last point that you make, I mean, that went to the Missouri Supreme Court. The Missouri Supreme Court, the Missouri Supreme Court was asked to nullify Amendment 5 because the voters had not been told what it was going to do. And the Supreme Court's reaction to that was, well, it really didn't do anything. So the voters weren't misled. So that's what leads now to this decision that Amendment 5 didn't do anything. Therefore, nonviolent offenders still can't have guns.
Thanks for the call. Just a couple of minutes left, and I want to save this for the end and for Mark to give an opportunity to show his stuff. That would be the challenges now to online gambling, which is a subject very close to your heart, I know, Mark. What do you think? Is online gambling gambling?
I just want to make clear, I don't have a gambling problem. I have a poker problem. It's a subset. So it's much more narrower. This is an area that's very much up in the air, and people don't know. So, like, when all the online poker sites were shut down, what was that, like 5-10 years ago? It wasn't because the federal government had said online poker playing is illegal. What had happened was they passed a law that said you can't, the banks can't transfer money to an online poker site. That was illegal. And then there were all these shams. They were making it look like instead of sending money to a poker site, it was you were buying sleeping bags or something like that. So these sites, I think there's also a question about, are they all on the up and up? And so some of the states want to get in and regulate it. So this is kind of, you've got this unclear legal. Then you've got these businesses, the big legal casinos that are losing all kind of money to these guys, and they want a cut of the action. So I think what will happen, if I had a guess, I would think these sites could be banned in certain states, although it's hard with the internet.
And they have been in some already.
Yeah. I think New Jersey did. But, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with the internet, you don't know where people are. So it's so easy, and you got off, you know, out-of-the-country sites. So I think there'll always be a way to do gambling.
Is that something that can be stopped? I mean, it is the internet.
I think it's tough, yeah. I think it's very tough. Although, you know, they shut down. These people can't then come in the United States. You know, I was looking at some stuff. Actually, I think it was Catherine Hanaway when she was U.S. attorney for Eastern District. I think she testified and said playing poker online wasn't illegal. So that's my precedent. That's my defense.
And maybe your hope. Even.
Yeah, if I ever get in trouble.
I only have a minute left. Very, very quickly, I'll go to each one of you. A final thought about the Scalia story. Jared, final?
I wasn't prepared for it. I think a lot of folks talk about, as Bill stated in the election, that the next president will have the ability to appoint X number of Supreme Court justices, but I didn't think this would come to fruition so quickly and become, I think, the number one issue in the election going forward.
Mark?
Well, I would say, you know, you get all these people talking about we can't have Scalia replaced by some liberal. But, I mean, Clarence Thomas replaced Thurgood Marshall. Scalia replaced I'm blanking. The leader of the
– White?
No, it was the Burger Court.
Burger.
I mean, because Rehnquist opened up his seat. I mean, so that happens all the time.
Very quickly, Bill.
Well, I think Americans should brace themselves because they are going to hear more about the Supreme Court and Heller and living and dead constitutions over the next 10-9 months than they ever expected to.
Fascinating cocktail talk.
Yeah. The Republicans are saying let the American public decide in the next election who the next justice should be. Elizabeth Warren said over the weekend the American public raised its voice in the last election
right.
when Obama got 5 million more votes than the other guy. Okay, leave it at that. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with cybersecurity expert Charlie Miller about some of the latest issues in that industry. And in the next installment of Soundbites produced with Sauce Magazine, we'll explore the trend in artisanal bread. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. Thanks to Jared Boyd, Mark Smith, and Bill Freivogel for today's program. And thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.